And with our special guest tonight, Brad Steiger, let's do a little shape-shifting when we come back and talk about some ghosts. He's got an incredible expertise in that arena. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Brad, how did you get involved in ghost writing and hunting? How did that all happen for you?
Well, I had no choice, I guess. I was born into a house. And in those days, you really were born into a house.
You were. No hospital for you, huh?
No, actually, it was the big blizzard of 36. That's legendary here in the Midwest. And my mother was away, and myself were away from home for 2 months before we could get back through the great blizzard. At any rate, the house and the property on which I grew up was formerly an old stagecoach stop. Hmm. So you can imagine the kind of emotions and tension that might have been there. And many a time, you know, we'd get up at night hearing, you know, like horses and wagons and so forth coming down. And I could remember.
Not just you, the entire family.
Yeah. I can remember coming to the window and there would be mom and my sister. And I said, well, you heard it too. And they'd say, uh-huh. Well, then, of course, we had doors opening and closing. We had just a wide range of phenomena. But I think it started even before I was perceptive of that. Like I said, even my mom said at the beginning of the program, I said, you know, I just never slept. So I was sitting one night on my bed, and I saw this man and this woman come walking out of the corner of the room. They were very stern looking, and they just looked at me. They did nothing else. Well, you know how it is when you're a little kid, you crawl under the covers and then you peek out again. They weren't gone, and I repeated it, and they still were there, and this happened night after night. So I thought, well, they're obviously not going to hurt me, so
I'll have to live with them, huh?
Yeah. And then I found out that, well, they had lived there first. They were my great grandparents, whom came over from the old country in 1888 and had originally settled there, and I guess we're still checking in. So I saw them some years later in a family album, of course, and recognized them. So I guess I found from the beginning that maybe I kind of perceived things that others didn't, and sometimes I'd talk about it, sometimes I wouldn't. The fascination was conflicted with me, George, because I was reared also in an evangelical Christian.
So you were tugging at yourself.
Yeah, because on one hand, I knew what I saw, but then my salvation was my mom and my sister, who also saw these things.
Sure.
Dad had the position. I know he had to see them. He just never admitted it. But he never laughed or made fun of us or criticized us. He just would say to me when the two of us were alone, you know, just be sure you've eliminated all other possibilities before you say it's a spook or whatever. So I used that. Now, it was beautiful for me because years later, I got a call from another part of the state, and these farmers said that UFOs appeared so regularly that you could set your watch by them. So I called my dad and I said, do you want to go for a long drive with me and set your watch? And he said, yeah. He came along, and George, the UFOs just appeared. They didn't come. They were just there.
They were there. Like they came through a dimension?
Like they came through a dimension, which is probably my principal theory of UFOs.
Me too. I'm starting to get to that too.
Yeah. And Dad, God bless him, he grabbed someone's, there were several patrolmen there, attorneys, several people.
So everybody witnessed this.
Yeah, everyone saw it. And he put those, grabbed the binoculars from the guy, and I was afraid he's going to have two black eyes. He just rammed those
Yeah.
binoculars. And then on the way home, he said, "You know, part of me has always believed, but," he said, "I'm the kind of guy that just has to see for myself." And I said, "I know that, Dad, and I think you saw tonight." So I was really delighted that, you know, we got to experience that together because, you know, growing up, my dad, well, he still is. He's my hero. I mean, he's
Good for you.
kind of the guy that I hope that I'm halfway.
Well, you know what? I'm sure he's been very proud of you.
Now, he passed several years ago,
But he's still proud of you.
I feel him, and I dream about him a lot, and that he passed just when that's when Sherry and I lived in Arizona, and they were just on their way out to see us. And
You've written well over what, 150 plus books by now?
164,
My
George.
gosh, you talk about being prolific. You've written more than Stephen King.
Yeah, not as rich as Stephen King.
Well, but maybe in spirit, huh? But the
No, it truly, truly. You don't do this type of work for the money. Everything, I mean, you put it into your research, and that's what people don't understand. And doggone it, you know, both Sherry and I have this sense of mission. And sometimes we say, "Wouldn't it be easier?" You know, but then we say, "But we wouldn't be
Yeah,
us."
I've got my first one coming out soon. I hope it's at the publishers now, and now it goes through the legalese that it needs to go through.
Right.
It's about my life in the paranormal world. I'm going to give a portion of the proceeds away to listeners who need it. You
Great.
know, why take it to the grave? I'd rather make somebody's life happy.
That's wonderful, George. And I look forward to reading it.
Okay, and I'll sign one for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, I've read a lot of your books. I love them all,
Thank you.
but I love the werewolf book
Thank you.
because it just touches these things that really, to me, are spooky. And I've got to talk to you about some of the things that are in it and things that are going on. And of course, the word and phrase shapeshifters has always been intriguing to me. But I want your take on that.
Well, there are no coincidences because just a few days ago, I began hearing. I get the most reports from Native Americans with the shape shifting. And a woman who I guess I met, I was honored to be the keynote speaker at the gathering of the Plains Indians some years ago. And several people made their acquaintance with me, and they were kind enough to say that, you know, it was so strange because there were all Native Americans there, and the committee said, "Brad, you'll be so proud. There are no Anglos speaking. We're all Native Americans." Well, I guess Scandinavians are considered the Indians of Europe, I guess. So I was honored to be the keynote speaker at the
That's great.
gathering, and there were many people there, and I guess this Apache family had met me and talked with me at some time. So again, they just out of the blue, it so seemed, but there's nothing out of the blue, sent me quite a detailed accounting of shape-shifting and the medicine practice, and just what a real thing that is for them, and how they had seen shapeshifters, and it is part of their culture, is part of their belief. The wolf boys, the people who, and she asked if I had pictures of people shapeshifting, and I said no, but a couple years ago, someone promised to send George Nuri and me a video. Do you remember
I do.
that?
I didn't get mine yet.
I didn't get mine yet, but I've had a lot of claimants since. So this is a fascinating area, and I think it's, you know, it is part of the shamanic tradition of all people, not just Native Americans.
Well, when they shift, is it immediate or is there like some gradual chronology that might last hours or weeks or even months? Or is it just happen like that?
Well, you know, I've got to see certain things before I can accept them. To me, This is a shamanic thing, and it's in Europe, all the tribes. And let's face it,
I mean, do you
Philip,
believe it?
I believe that people spiritually shapeshift.
Okay.
And I've hear from a lot of people who spiritually shapeshift.
But the shamans believe it's a physical thing, too.
They believe it's a physical
yeah.
thing. And I remember discussing this many, many years ago with a Cherokee psychiatrist, and his secretary was Navajo. And she claimed, and her family claimed, experiences where she was sitting at the bus stop, and a coyote, you know, comes running up to her on its hind legs. And so she knew it was a shapeshifter. Now, I wrote a novel about this, which nearly got made into a movie called The Chindi, which is when an entity possesses an animal and they begin, they walk on their hind legs and so forth,
okay.
and it's evil. And there's a whole tradition in the Navajo of the Chindi that, and one, and this is a true story, wiped out almost all of a family,
oh,
one
my.
By one. Now, whether this was part of their belief, but they swear, you know, that this is an independent entity of negativity.
So it maybe it was some murderer in their midst, but maybe not.
It was not a human murderer, but how they died was terrible, and everyone mysterious, kind of like a locked room mystery, you know.
Yeah.
No one could get at them, but yet they were ripped apart. So these are things that happen, and we can't judge. We cannot have the arrogance to project, believe we can project into someone else's culture and judge it. So we have to observe, we have to be discriminate, we have to be discreet. In my interpretation, watching and being gifted, I guess, many opportunities, Sherry, of course, being Swedish and Chippewa, she's been invited to ceremonies that I have not been invited to, and
mm-hmm.
I envy her very much those.
Sure.
But the dancing and so forth that I have seen, the imitation of the animal is so incredible. The movement, the dance, the movement, the drum, the movement. And I think that, you know, it becomes an entranced state where one's spirit becomes that of the animal. Now, one of the books that I've written that has been very appreciated by Native Americans is my totem book. But I take it from a universal area. Like I say, George, we're part of a tribe too. Our people were tribes in Europe. Our people were tribes in Asia.
Yeah.
That's not just
yeah.
the Native American.
No, that's
thing.
True.
So we all have tribes, and we all have this in common. Now, it's interesting with the werewolf, with the wolf. In the beginning, early humans wanted to be wolves.
Why?
Because the wolf has a great sense of hunting.
True.
The wolf, they patterned their community structure on the wolf with the pack.
It's a survivor.
The survivor, the way it hunts, the way it doesn't kill indiscriminately, just what it needs. And they joined with the wolf then in fighting the larger predators. It's interesting, you know, the cat-dog thing. That's ancestral from the time when, well, let me rephrase that. We as humans only have one natural enemy, only one animal stalks us.
That's
and what's that?
That's our own.
That's the cat.
Oh, the cat.
The cat. The tiger.
Oh,
the lion.
Okay. Okay. No, you're right. You're right.
The saber-toothed tiger.
Okay. I was going to just say other humans.
Yeah. The bear. Sure, the bear will mess with you if you get between
if
it and
get,
its cub.
Yeah, exactly.
But bears don't come in hunting us. But what happens? I mean, how many cougar deaths do we have in California and in New Mexico every year?
Yeah. Yeah.
People out jogging, and boy, that's...
They attack.
That's slower than a deer, baby. And right on the back, snap the back, they're gone.
Why do they attack?
Because we're easy prey. We're easy prey. Have you seen that magnificent film, The Ghost in the Darkness?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a true story.
That was a tremendous movie.
A tremendous movie. And that's the situation, you know, that dogs then see a cat, and instantly they're on guard because, you know, a cat is a cat is a cat. You can watch a lion or tiger in the zoo. You can watch your cat beside you, the same actions, the same movements, the same. Now, here's something that upsets me, and I know we're bouncing all over the place, George. Do you know that there are 6,000 Bengal tigers that are kept as pets in this country?
6,000?
Bengal tigers, more than in the jungles of India. And that, where are they kept? They're kept in apartments. They're kept in backyards. They're kept in houses.
Oh, my gosh.
I in know, apartments.
What kind of tigers did Siegfried and Roy have?
Yeah, Bengals.
Bengals?
Big,
yeah.
Big white Bengal tigers.
Yep, that's what I thought. Now, in his case, I'm still not sure that tiger attacked him. I think he was falling. Some people said he had a stroke first. I think that cat might have been trying to protect him and just, you know, held on to him.
Well, that's what he feels. And, yeah, you know, it could be. But the thing is people are trying to make pets out of animals that we must respect for their sovereignty, for what they are. And when we try to get a tiger, you know the way the cat, if you're bend over or whatever, your cat will jump playfully on you. So will the Bengal tiger. We lived, when we were in Scottsdale, there was someone who had two Bengal tigers, and he would drive around in his Jeep with that Bengal tiger sitting beside him in the front seat, which was pretty exciting. You come up to the stop sign, you look over, and there's a Bengal tiger looking at you.
Yeah, he's having a grand old time.
Right. But he said he always had to stand up as straight as possible, because if you're taller than they are, they're intimidated by you. So that's why if you encounter a cougar, even a bear, when you're out in the wild, you stand up and stretch your arms. You look as big as you can.
You better go to sleep standing up then with one of those things around.
That's right. Anyway, I'm sorry.
That's okay. But, you know, getting back to the werewolves then.
Right, right. So man began dancing and trying to invoke the spirit of the wolf, because the wolf is powerful. The wolf is a great hunter. So when we go on the hunt tomorrow, I want to be a wolf. I want the spirit of the wolf in me. So he would dance. And then there was, this is kind of a bad thing, the wilding that would develop from that. Sometimes they would become crazed and frenzied when they would, too many of them would do this at a time, and they would take off and they'd run through villages, and they would actually bite and eat people and destroy peasants and their cottages and so forth. Then there's the tradition of the wolf singer. Wolves would attack their flocks, so one member of the early tribe would be designated to sing or to howl, mm-hmm, to keep the wolves at bay. So we began by wanting to be wolves. So it is easy to assume then that as we evolved, some people would still have that fascination, some people would have that obsession. And then we're finding out now that early Neanderthal man may have been cannibalistic, may have eaten human Homo sapiens flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And come on, what if you were out walking and you saw a Neanderthal, what would you think? That is a man beast. So we surely have a memory, because they say that Homo sapiens and Neanderthal lived side by side for maybe 150,000 years, maybe 200,000.
Right. Well, at least man won out on this one, maybe because of his brain.
Right. That was the difference. Now, again, we're finding out Neanderthal was much smarter than we had assumed before. So maybe some of those Neanderthals grabbed us, trapped us. And that's in our ancestral memory.
I still wonder if Bigfoot might be one of those. You know?
Oh, Bigfoot. There again, I chased Bigfoot for so many years.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, when we come back, I want to ask you a few more werewolf questions tied into the full moon and why that is always either a legend or it seems to affect people in a very strange way. We'll be back in a moment. Brad Steiger, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. And with our special guest tonight, Brad Steiger. Hey, by the way, there's not much time left. The After Dark newsletter is always available to you, but the free CD, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin called Perfect Possession, That will not be. So you get it free right now when you subscribe or renew by calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online, coasttocoastam.com. All right, we're with Brad Steiger. Brad, the myth of werewolves, of people shifting into werewolves, full moons, how did that start?
Well, the full moon has long said to have an effect on humans, and I don't care how many doctors deny it. I see about every year someone comes out, no, there's no effect on the full moon. However, if you speak to doctors at emergency wards, they tell an entirely different story.
Sure. Or emergency medical technicians.
Exactly. Yep. Now, interestingly, when the werewolf book came out, I got a letter from someone who sat beside me in English class in 1953, and she is now the head administrator at a mental institution. And she said, there's no question at a full moon. That's when all the regular staff calls in sick. That's when they can't get any volunteers because no one wants to be on duty during the full moon.
Now, do we know if it's a physical effect or whether it just, you know, they look at a full moon, they know it's a full moon, their mind plays tricks, and they just go and get wacko all of a sudden?
Well, you know, there are about as many explanations as there are so-called experts to explain them. It just seems to be a phenomenon. We're fascinated by the moon. Some people say, you know, it's the pull. It's like the pull of the tides, the full moon pulls, and we're two-thirds liquid, so that's part of it.
That's exactly what I heard. You know, we've got water in our system,
exactly.
60-70%.
Yeah. Who knows? But I know that it does have an effect. And people love the full moon, and you know, whether they feel it within. Now, the people who have lycanthropy, some people truly, truly, George, have a mental condition.
Right.
That they believe they are werewolves. And some of the, you know, some people laugh when I recount some of the effects that they have, but you know, it's really not funny if it should be a relative of your own
or us
or us, because some of these people I hear, you know, they have to keep the man or the woman in a room for the days before and the days after, and the person requires, they have to get it through an opening in the door, they have to give raw meat. I mean, I've heard this from many people who suffer this or a like kind of situation, their eyes truly become bright red, like a werewolf's. Now, in some, it seems to be hereditary. I've heard now from many people who say, you know, it's in my family. It's in my family. It's come down through generations. You know, there's always been a member of the family that suffers from this. Now, they are not lycanthropists. They simply believe, or excuse me, not simply, they believe they truly are werewolves. Now, they don't go out attacking people, but they do become very violent, and they will attack if they are provoked. Their temper becomes just on edge. It's like they're just, and that's why they have to be confined. Again, in another situation, the person claimed, again, that this gets a little into vampirism, because you know there are clubs where they do suck of one another's blood.
Yes, and they get their teeth put in by dentists.
That's right, and even right here in River City, we have kids walking around like that. It becomes part of a werewolf thing too, then, to feel the wolf. Now, I respect that. I've been honored many, many years ago. Decades ago, I was adopted into the wolf clan of the Seneca tribe, and I have great respect, and I feel very honored. But the Native Americans who feel this, you know, the wolf is the great teacher. To the Native American, The wolf is the great teacher. It teaches. It is the symbol of passing on the traditions.
Well, how did they get this? You could kill a werewolf creature with like a silver bullet.
Do you know where that came from?
Huh.
The Wolfman, Lon Chaney.
They just created that?
Yeah. And,
okay.
And the little chant that everyone says, you know, even a man who is full, who is pure of heart during the wolf bane, you know, blooms, he can become a wolf and so forth. He just made that up. He made that old honorable tradition up. Now, there is a tradition where when they hunted the great wolf in Le Vent Jourdain in France, some of them did use silver from that had served on the church altars and blessed with holy water. So there is kind of a shaky tradition of the silver bullet, but basically that's an invention of Hollywood.
Would you consider Dracula a shapeshifter?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the original story, he's also turns into a wolf. In the original stage drama, when Dracula did that, they threw a German shepherd on stage. So Dracula is a shapeshifter, but that has been lost in this sexy image that Bela Lugosi put on. Now, the vampire looks like Nosferatu. Have you seen Nosferatu?
Yes. Now that, to me, is what a vampire should look like.
That is what a vampire should look like. That is a vampire.
An ugly creature.
Yeah, an ugly, rodent-like, hideous creature. But Bela then changed that with his interpretation on stage when he came on with the evening dress and he was an enormous sex symbol at his time.
Well, I was going to say, I bet women during that era wanted to get bitten by the guy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He you know, people look at it now and think it's kind of camp, but that original Dracula still has an enormous power. You know, the sets, I mean, they're just fabulous. But getting back to the wolf then, in the Middle Ages, people devised, you would wear a wolf girdle, you would drink from the paw water in the paw print of a wolf, and then there's all kinds of ritual things that you would say, rub wolf fat on you and so forth, and then you would become a wolf. Now, spiritual shape-shifting, I have a section in the werewolf book where I relay a technique, a creative visualization that I've used in workshops and so forth to become a spiritual wolf. And many people have used that, and I hear from many spiritual shape-shifters who become in their spirit, in their mind, as if you were a shaman now, George, as if you were a shaman, not to do harm to anyone, but just to experience that freedom and that strength and that running in the night under the moon and so forth. It's an exhilarating kind of experience, but again, it's not intended as a negative thing, but as an illumination.
The shifting, of course, seems to go through some various incantations, both in the werewolf, in Dracula, Jekyll and Hyde. That was another one. You highlight that well in the werewolf book.
Yeah, that is really a werewolf story.
And it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the ultimate, where man changes into beast.
Well, that's true. Okay, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
And then there's the battle within. Whether the good part of him wins out over the bad, and generally it's the bad one that always wins. Why is that?
So in the spiritual shape-shifting, again, you're letting the courage of the wolf, the wisdom of the wolf, that's what you allow to break through. But you see, if you're emphasizing the negativity, then the savageness of the wolf, the power of the wolf, the caniness, the sneaking attack, that aspect of the wolf comes out. So again, my friends listening out there, you don't play around with some of these things. You know, I know there's a lot of role playing right now. People are playing vampire, they're playing werewolf, but you have to emphasize the positive aspect. Now, we should mention one thing too. In Lon Chaney's Wolfman, there we have the archetype. We have the what has been set for many, many years in Hollywood. But they finally have been getting it right, because when you become a werewolf, it's not a wolf man. You literally become a wolf. So in Werewolf London, Werewolf of Paris, some of these other movies where they change, The Howling, where they change completely into a wolf, that's really what the werewolf tradition is. Not a wolf man like Lon Chaney, who he kind of looked like, I don't know what, you know, a beaver or something in his face. But, you know, that was great at the time, and I still love that movie.
Tell me about Incubus. What is that?
Incubus, we always have with us. I mean, we receive an enormous amount of mail. Incubus is a demon, a fallen angel, that sexually molests women as they sleep.
I see.
And the succubus molests men. And we have so many emails from people who feel they are being sexually molested or being troubled by incubi and succubi.
How much is in their mind? How much might really be happening?
Well, it's truly happening to them. Some of them wake up with scratches and marks that, you know, they couldn't self-administer.
Man.
On our website, George, we, you know, this is our gift to people. We have on the S files, that's S for Steiger, you can click on that, scroll down, and you will find techniques for cleansing the home, for creating positive dreams, and also for banishing or freeing yourself from discarnate entities, from this type of molestation, which, I don't know, I think the veil between worlds is becoming thinner, because that's one thing that we receive, an enormous amount of emails, demonic attack and incubi and succubi attacks. So this is, and it works. I mean, if you are serious, these techniques and exercises work. We've given them to dozens of people who claim, you know, that they, in one case, an individual was molested for years. And after using our techniques, exercise, we can't say they're ours, but we give them, you know, their prayers, their exercises, their mental techniques that you can use to get yourself out of a situation. Maybe, you know, I'll speak frankly now, that if you're a heavy drinker, if you're smoking the herb, if you're doing several things, you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position.
Why is that?
Because your normal restraints are being lowered. Your normal resistance is being lowered. Your values are being lowered. And these entities, that's when they can possess. That's when they can enter. That's when they can seize control. They've never had a body. They've never had a body, but they surely want to borrow yours for a while, and they want to feel maybe some of the baser emotions and some of the lower animal instinct that you know that on one level you are capable of. So when you are vulnerable through drink or drugs or sex addiction, you can then become prey for these discarnate entities.
Wow. You know, the mind really does work over matter then, doesn't it?
That's true. That is true. You see, it's all a matter of consciousness, what we consider consciousness. And that's the big question. That is the big question in science, in psychology, in psychiatry. No one yet understands what consciousness is. No one can define where the observer is. Where is the sense of self? How does that develop? No one knows yet. We are not collective species. We are individuals. When does that sense of individuality arise? No one knows what sleep is. No one knows why we dream. Sure, we know that we do sleep and we do dream, but science has not yet, in spite of all the sleep labs and clinics and dream labs, no one knows. I mean, this is true. People who say, I don't believe in the paranormal or psychic phenomena, I say, man, you sleep and you dream and you, I think, therefore I am. Those are the greatest mysteries of, you know, that we have, and we haven't come anywhere near solving them.
You're talking a little bit, we didn't quite finish it, of lycanthropy.
Yeah.
And exactly what is that?
Well, that's when one truly believes that you become a wolf. And during this period, usually the full moon.
A wolf vampire, but or a wolf specifically.
Wolf, okay. Lycanthrope, that's wolf, you see. Lycanthrope, that's wolf love or
okay,
wolf-like.
Okay.
And they literally get down on all fours. They growl, they snap, they will attack. Now, again, I know this sounds humorous, but, you know, one woman became so obsessed that she got out of her house. She got out of the hospital in her care, and she literally ran off into the world and literally was run over by a car because was trying to bite the tires. Now, that sounds like a sick joke, but if it was your aunt or your sister, you wouldn't think it was funny.
Oh, my God. No, that's unbelievable.
And then some people have, you know, appeared to be cured for a while, and then the family will find them out in the graveyard, you know, howling. It's not funny. It's truly a mental disorder and does require treatment. And then there are the people who, no, they don't have lycanthropy. They simply believe, and they have a tradition of in the family. And again, we have many, many Native Americans who you know, they don't attack anyone, they don't hurt anyone, but during that time, you know, they feel they do shapeshift. They feel. Now, I hope that I'm going to be getting more information from these medicine people who have begun writing me. And George, if we finally get those pictures, I'll be sure to send
we'll get them. You will link them up with your website. If they're there.
We will put them up on the website.
You know what? There are so many strange things on this planet, though, Brad. I don't know sometimes the difference between reality and not, because I think a lot of these things are very possible.
Well, I have to stay open. You know, things like shape-shifting, I see completely as a shamanic tradition where you focus on your totem animal, you become your totem animal, you go into a trance-like state, and you explore the greater reality, another dimension of reality, as your totem or with your totem as your guide. Now, I have no problem with that.
I'm beginning to wonder even if David Icke is correct in he believes reptilians are extraterrestrials and they've already shape-shifted into humans, but they can go back anytime they want.
Well, we may have that again. To me, you know, I like to interpret that on the spiritual level. The actual shape-shifting, the actual changing of the cellular structure of the physical body, I just find very hard to accept, but I can't say it's impossible. I can't say, and I'm open, and believe me, when I get these emails from individuals all over the world, I encourage them, and I'm very open. If you can demonstrate this, boy, I want to see it. I have to. I have witnessed in my life, you know, the things that I would not have believed possible when I was younger and knew everything. Now I realize that I know so little, and I have to stay open and explore and continue to study and search and seek.
Let's open up the phone lines for the last hour, Brad. We'll take calls on pet miracles if people want to share them with you, or even the shape-shifting that we've talked about, okay? We'll open up the phone lines. This is it. Final hour to go with our very special guest tonight, none only than Brad Steiger. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.